So good evening, everyone. And we can start if someone has any questions you'd like to ask. Everything from last week was crystal clear and raised no concerns, no controversy, no confusion. Everybody's completely understanding so far the Buddhist path. It's completely obvious. That's good.
I was wondering, Buddhism is that confused? If you could tell us a little bit about the forms of
different forms of love, so we get to know, you know, what's right, what's real, and what's real. So you want to know about the different forms of love from last week, and the difference between helpful forms of love that are helpful on the path, and those which are not so helpful, or those which can lead to suffering. And the main distinction is whether there's clinging as part of it. And if there's clinging as part of the love, then it's not considered to be so helpful. And so what we're looking for to cultivate in Buddhist practice, or to find within us, is the capacity to love but have no clinging. So it's not a love of exchange. It doesn't really matter if someone loves you back, for example. Or you're not loving someone because you get something in return, like, you know, security or whatever you get. Praise or admiration, or you know, it's the love doesn't require anything in return because there's no clinging to it. So it's kind of you could almost say a kind of self-generating love that certainly has something to do with the person that is the object of the love, but it's more self-generating as opposed to being generated in a sense from, you know, your desires and wishes for that in relationship to that person. So the main distinction is there clinging or not. And it's very hard to take these Pali words, the Sanskrit words. There's a whole series of them, and how they're used in colloquial Pali or Sanskrit, and how they're used in Buddhist texts. And differentiate all these and understand how to translate them into English. There's a word like pemma, which in the Buddhist vocabulary is considered to be usually translated as affection in English. And affection seems pretty innocent, but the Buddhists understand that it's a kind of affection that has clinging as part of it. So pemma is not usually not considered to be so desirable to have. Whereas loving kindness, which is really kind of a feeling of love that really wants the best for the other person, it has a tremendous sense of goodwill as part of it, but there's no expectation or anything in return. That is considered to be a healthy form of love.
Is that what the Buddha means when he refers to, if you do something right, then you can take the delight in it? Is that,
if you do something right, then take delight in it?
Yeah, is delight, is that what he means?
Delight, I think the kind of sense of delight and happiness in our good qualities or our good activities and actions is considered to be separate from love. So we can delight in having loving kindness, or we can delight in being generous. And it can be glad in the heart. And I suppose that the kind of uplifting feeling of the heart, being gladdened or delighted, could be understood by some people as a form of love or associated with love in the way that people feel when they get uplifted. I can imagine that. But I think of them as different. So for some people, it's a very foreign idea that there could be love without any expectation of anything in return. And you know, some people say it's kind of seems maybe even inhuman. You know, why would I want that? And why would I want that, right? And so there's two things. One is Buddhist path only filling what you want in some narrow sense of wants, or is it something else? And so if Buddhists often make a distinction is between narrow-minded goals and broad-minded goals. Or in Zen, sometimes they talk about small self and large self. If desire comes from the small self, that's the kind of egotistical self that just wants to build up its status or its reputation, wants to be liked by people, or wants to just fulfill its desires or its likes and dislikes. That's a very, that's kind of a small self or the narrow kind of view of things. And then the large self, or the big mind, or the pure heart, or different languages are used for this. We might still want something for ourselves, but it's not for that small self. It's for this big self, this broad self, where the self almost disappears. It's almost not focused on oneself at all. Does that make sense? Yes.
On that same topic, we notice that there is the clinging that's attached. I'm curious if the prescription for that is to say then to turn away from that feeling that you know is not thinking, looking, and I love somebody, but it's got the clinging, to renounce it and say, hey, I go there.
So the question is, if you're aware that you love someone and you're also aware that it's clinging as part of that love, do you then just turn your back on that and kind of just reject that, you know, renounce that, forget that? I'm not going to get involved, you know. And there are some people who take that choice. I don't know if it's always the wise thing to do. There's so many different causes and conditions that come into play about how a person might decide what to do. But, you know, generally, you know, one of the things to try to do is to try to tease apart the love from the clinging. And then if the two are confused with each other or entwined with each other, then you think the only opportunity, only thing you could really do is let go of it. But if you, sometimes it's possible to tease them apart, and then you can learn how to let go of the clinging, but not the love. And another attitude approach that some people take is that it's kind of like looking at the percentages. You know, if 70% of your motivation is pure and 30% of something is impure, don't sacrifice the pure because of the impure. So if you 70% of your love is really beautiful and pure and wonderful, and 30% of it involves some clinging, it's just kind of a tragedy that the 30%, you know, of the clinging should destroy the 70% which is beautiful. So you kind of look at the percentage and say, well, you know, I guess I'll live with the clinging for a while and, you know, try to work on it and try to work with it, but I'm not going to reject something that's so beautiful. So, enough about love. You've heard all you wanted to hear about it. And we should move on to other things now, more important things. So I've been talking about the Buddhist path as being kind of like a pyramid. And you want to get the different layers well established and firm so you can go higher and higher in the pyramid. And the kind of the base of the pyramid has to do with right understanding, kind of understanding what you're doing when you're doing the Buddhist path, kind of understanding what it's all about, and clarifying at the understanding level. And then the next layer is understanding your intention, your motivation. Because one thing is to understand what Buddhism is, it's another thing then to want to do something about it. My father once said, after I was ordained as a Zen priest, my father said, well, you know, this Buddhism stuff, you know, it seems, you know, nice, you know, it makes sense. But I don't understand why anybody would want to practice it. And you can go out and do, you know, have fun, you know, instead. And so one thing is to kind of understand the principles of practice, and the other is to then want to apply it in your life. And some people, that's a very important step, because some people kind of would like to do it, you know, they'd like to do it eventually, they'll get around to it, and then getting around to it ends up they don't do it, or it's important, but they don't really, it feels very important for them, but to really translate that sense of importance into action, or into actually motivation to actually act on, is a huge step. And some people can feel, this is really important for me, and they're inspired when they read Dharma books or Buddhist books, and it's going to be very important for them to have the orientation, know that's a possibility. But, you know, they don't really take the, you know, that motivation to really do something about it. There's a great story of an English Vipassana teacher, or Dharmic Buddhist teacher, I think in the 1950s. And he had been introduced to Buddhism, or discovered it as a teenager, and really taken to it and become a Buddhist in a time when there was very little Buddhism in England, or, you know, at all, compared to nowadays. And had kind of become an adult and become a Buddhist teacher of sorts. And we'd go around and give Dharma talks, give talks about Buddhism around England. And one day he was giving a Dharma talk, or a talk, and he said, I forget exactly what he said, but it was something like, um, Buddhist practice or Buddhist faith in Buddhism needs to be verified. You have to verify the teachings for yourself. And he heard himself say that, and he stopped, and he said, "I'm a charlatan. I haven't done it for myself." And the next day, he set sail for Thailand and became a monk, and eventually then practiced for many years, and then came back to be a teacher again. So even someone who makes it such a big part of their life, translated to actually having the motivation to do, to act, to engage in it. And people will have a huge range of how much a person might get engaged in doing practice, right? Anything from being a weekend Buddhist to going off for a lifetime being a monastic, a monk or nun, or going off and doing a 10-day retreat, or there's some people meditating every day for an hour, or there's a whole range of what people might do. It has a lot to do with the value they see in it and how motivated they are. So those two things are very important at the foundation: understanding what you're doing, and then your level of your motivation. And the third layer has to do now with the world of ethics. We're having to do with the world of your relationship to other people. So ethics, morality, virtue, establishing a healthy relationship to other people, not by faking it, but by really paying attention to what goes on the inside and trying to cultivate a virtuous heart, a virtuous mind, where you're inclined, out of maybe almost a habit, to act in ways which are kind with the people around you, not going to hurt them or harm others in any kind of way. The next layer of the pyramid is that of generosity. Not just Buddhism, but a lot of Asian religious traditions, probably Western ones also, put a tremendous value on generosity, the virtue of generosity. Not only because it's a good thing to do socially, it creates wonderful society when we're generous, but it also because it's a way of cultivating ourselves. It's cultivating healthy relationships to the people we give to, and as we try to discover what healthy giving is. And we get to look at ourselves, understand where we cling, where we hold on, understand what it's like to have an open-handed, open-hearted kind of approach to life. And there's a lot of change, inner change that happens as we cultivate generosity. I don't know if I told the story last time, right? We talked about generosity, but I've known people who have had, because of their psychological reasons, had a very hard time actually doing meditation practice. And their Buddhist teachers instructed them to practice generosity instead. And it had a huge effect on them. It was to their benefit, this practice of generosity. Then what we talked about last week is still in this realm of kind of interpersonal, taking care of the interpersonal life and finding ourselves, discovering ourselves in the relationship to other people and refining ourselves, developing our character in a sense in relationship to the interpersonal world. So that was love, talking about the Buddhist idea of love and love not being something you can leave to chance. You just kind of walk into a room, you see someone, and chemistry works. But love is something you can cultivate and develop. You don't have to leave it to chance. And so there are practices for cultivating loving kindness, for cultivating compassion, which is a form of love, and the other forms of love we talked about. One of the important values of doing these foundational aspects of the practice is as Olivia said, is to delight oneself, to have happiness. And not to take these things on as moralistic things, or you should, or it's a duty, a good Buddhist is supposed to do all these things, and I'm going to be a good Buddhist and get merit badges or whatever. It's really to help lighten the heart, lighten who you, so you can live more lightly and joyfully in life, so that you don't have to be burdened by your ethics or by all kinds of things, but rather have a feeling of lightness of being because you go through life in a very generous, open, loving kind of way. And then to feel happiness in doing these things. To feel happiness in your good qualities, to feel happiness in your good activities is considered to be an important part of the Buddhist path. For some Westerners, this is a foreign idea. It feels self-centered, it feels something wrong, it feels somehow... And to somehow feel happiness in oneself, or oneself does. But this is considered very healthy and helpful as long as it's not self-centered, as long as it's not egotistical. But there's ways of, without being egotistical, to just feel great delight in one's own good qualities, and also a sense of humor for one's failings. But they kind of have a lightness of being, a lightness of heart, to cultivate a kind of happiness and gladness. So in the classic offering of the Buddhist path, these are the kind of foundational elements. And they're very, very transformative, very, very significant. In the West, we often overlook them. We often turn the pyramid upside down, and we teach meditation first. And some people's attitude, like my attitude when I first started practicing, was that these things are kind of insignificant, not really that important to practice. I mean, I'm basically a good person, and I don't have to pay attention to any of this stuff. But there's, you know, deeper and deeper refinements possible of this this area of the interpersonal life, working on ourselves. All these layers of this bottom layers of the pyramid can be refined and deepened. The first foundation, that of understanding, will continue to be deepened the further you study and practice Buddhism. So it isn't like you get it once in place, once and for all. Now you have the right understanding what Buddhism is and the path is. But rather, as you keep deepening your practice, you understand more and more what that foundational element is like. So it's kind of self-reinforcing. It's kind of like a loop. So, you know, to cultivate these things and be interested in exploring and developing these aspects of our life is a very important part of the Buddhist life. There's a lot of Buddhists who, that's primarily what they do in their spiritual life, is they're cultivating these this interpersonal realm of ethics, generosity, and love. And as I've said, I want to underscore, if it doesn't bring you happiness to do these things, then you need to stop and take a really careful look. Why not? And what's going on with you that you're not feeling happy? Are you doing it because of some sense of obligation or burden? Or is your inner critic coming alive too much and kind of getting in the way? What is it that you have to work on and deal with so that you can feel a sense of lightness, being, a delight, a happiness in these foundational aspects of the Buddhist path? So that's one of the reasons why it's fun, you know, so part of the power of the foundation is that it creates this happiness and lightness of being. If it doesn't, part of the power of it is it helps you to look at why that's the case. And then you can figure out what to do about that, hopefully, work with it and do something. One of the things you might want to do is to go further along in the path, in the pyramid, even before you feel you're completely ready. Because meditation practice then can actually help deal with some of the inner critic and some of the hindrances, some of the obstacles to having happiness and lightness of being. So you don't have to kind of put off that. Sometimes it's wise to plunge into meditation. Sometimes it's wise to go to therapy. And sometimes it's wise to do other things. My friend John Travis, who's a teacher, he went to India and practiced meditation and with a lot of great teachers in the 60s there. And at some point, he felt kind of an obstacle in pursuing his spiritual life any further. He was hanging around a little bit in northern India at that time with Ram Dass was there. And so he went and saw his friend Ram Dass and said, you know, I feel this obstacle, you know. And he said, it's something to do with my father. And I said, oh, you have to go back to Tennessee to see your father. You have to go have to do darshan with your father. And so he went to a local tailor and wherever in India and got made this corduroy suit. He never wore a suit, cut his hair. He was a sadhu, kind of long-haired, wild and a hippie sadhu in India, and cut his hair and got this corduroy suit and flew back to Tennessee. And Ram Dass said, don't stay long. But he went to try to go back and kind of meet his father at his father's, you know, own context, his own level or whatever. And so he went back and, you know, visited with his father and kind of clarified that part of his life. And when he felt that was clarified well enough, then he went back to India and continued his practice there. So there are sometimes we have to do certain things to kind of take care of aspects of our life that are better done not through meditation, but through other kinds of activities. So we don't put all, you know, say meditation is the cure for all that ails us. Meditation is very, very powerful, but it's a mistake to think that meditation practice is going to fix it all. Sometimes we need to do other things along the way. So the next layer of the pyramid, and in my kind of schema for this class, it's maybe the second to last layer before the top. And that is, the level of cultivation. The word in Pali is bhavana. And that translates as cultivation or development. So that part of developing ourselves, cultivating ourselves. And the earlier part of the path also has to do with cultivation and development. But now, this is really much more explicitly, this is what we're doing now. It's not so much doing, you know, virtue for the sake of others or helping others and all that. But now we're really, really explicitly working on our own mind and developing it, cultivating it. And I'll tell you a little preview for next week. Next week it's going to be the part about letting go. And so we have these two pieces that actually work in dynamic together. Cultivating, doing something, acquiring a certain sense of certain kind of developing our capacities. And then the next aspect is letting go, and they work together. So it's not like necessarily so linear, one after the other. They work together. But they're both very important. And sometimes in practice we emphasize more one than the other. Sometimes cultivation is an important aspect, sometimes letting go. Some Buddhist traditions, as a traditions, emphasize more the cultivation side. Other traditions emphasize more the letting go side. Or different teachers emphasize one or the other. It's best not to take one as being the truth, the right way, but to see them in a dynamic working together. Almost every... A lot of Buddhist practice involves bringing different capacities into play, into balance with each other, and have them work together. So to have a kind of a simplistic idea that Buddhist practice is about cultivating concentration or mindfulness or only letting go or whatever is actually quite dangerous. As soon as someone says it's all about one thing, you should ask, you know, what else? What's being left out here that should be included as part of this? And it makes it for a little bit more complex. It's nice to have just one simple answer for your spirituality. Suzuki Roshi, who was a Zen master in San Francisco, he summarized Buddhism in three words. And he said, not always so. So you should remember that. So as soon as someone says, this is the way it is in Buddhism, not always so. Might be so 90% of the time, but you know, it's not always so. So, so there's more to the path than just... So anyway, cultivation and letting go. But this week we're talking about cultivation, exploring that important part of Buddhism. It's possible to develop oneself. It's possible to develop one's mental capacities. It's possible to develop one's physical capacities. And someone who is an athlete knows that, because otherwise they wouldn't train. Because they, you know, if they didn't feel they can develop themselves, they wouldn't train. They have no purpose in training if they want to win a race or do some great accomplishment. Someone who's a musician, practicing a piano or whatever the musical instrument is, they also have this idea they can develop themselves. They can develop their concentration. They can develop their sense of music and rhythm and, you know, all kinds of wonderful things. And those things can be developed. Someone who is a computer programmer, I know some computer programmers develop their capacity to be concentrated because it requires a lot of concentration to sit there in front of the screen and to focus and do your thing. And I know one friend of mine who has a very strong capacity for concentration attributes that in part to having his foundation of being a computer programmer for many years. And he cultivated and developed that capacity of concentration. So it's possible to develop ourselves. And so the path of cultivation is just working with that, realizing it's possible to change yourself, to cultivate, transform yourself through your activities. And so let's do it. Let's do it in order to help further the path, to go further down the path. It turns out that it's a lot easier to let go in the very profound ways that Buddhism wants you to let go, in the deepest places where you reach realization or enlightenment or great awakening, whatever. It's easiest to do that when you've cultivated a lot of strength, a lot of good qualities inside of you, cultivated your mind, your heart, to a certain degree. It's kind of like, what would be the analogy? That, you know, like skiing, right? So all you have to do when you're top of the slope is just let go. And down you go, you know, you'll get down. And when I took my son skiing last year, I tried to teach him some skiing, and it didn't work. He said, I know how to ski. And finally I just gave up, okay. And so... he went straight down and ran into the fence. There's a plastic fence that's there, so he didn't hurt himself. But and so that was the end of the skiing for that year. And he knew how to let go. But he hadn't cultivated other things, you know, certain kind of strength and skill and all these things. So it turns out it's easier, it's more realistic and actually more possible to do some of the deeper letting go when a person has cultivated themselves to a certain degree. So cultivation, developing oneself. There's a whole slew of things that Buddhists can cultivate. One of the nice things is that even if you just do something like try to concentrate on your breath, you're cultivating a lot of different capacities while you're trying to stay focused on your breath. So you don't have to kind of think a lot about these different things that you can develop, but all you have to do is start practicing, and a lot of things will come with the practice. But what I want to do is go through a list of five different things that classically are developed and strengthened as part of the Buddhist path. They're very important things to develop and strengthen. And I'd like to do this, to introduce you to them, while we're meditating. So, an important area of cultivation is cultivating our body, developing our body. Some people need to exercise more than they need to meditate. I think the body needs to be in tune, toned properly. If it's in order to really let meditation go far. Some people associate meditation only with relaxation. So they think the best way to meditate then is on a couch or in your bed with a lot of pillows laying down. But meditation is much more than relaxation. And you need it actually to have a relatively good sense of energy in your body, vitality in your body, to really take meditation as far as it can possibly take. Paying attention to your body and doing something to cultivate a good sense of vitality in your body is a really, really important part of Buddhism. The Buddha didn't teach that, I think, because he spent so much of his life walking across India and around India and walking. And so sometimes there's a lot of walking. That's enough. If you walk 3 or 4 hours a day, that's enough. So take a comfortable, alert posture. And gently close your eyes. And then set yourself at ease. Set yourself at ease in your body. At ease with how it is. Set yourself at ease with your heart, with your feelings, whatever they might be. Set yourself at ease with your mind, whatever's going on. And then feel your posture that you're sitting in. Especially how your torso is, your spine. And you might see if you can bring a little bit more vitality to your spine. It doesn't have to be much, but a little bit. Maybe by sitting up straighter, letting your attention travel up the vertebrae from the base to the top. As you feel your spine, adjust your posture so your spine's not being pulled forward or sideways or backwards. And then you might take a few long, slow, deep breaths, connecting to your body from the inside as your torso expands and stretches with the in-breath. And as you exhale, relax, let go. And let your breath return to normal. And then for a few minutes, ride on the waves of your breathing, on the expanding and contracting sensations of your body, or whatever sensations of breathing that you have in your body. Kind of ride them, float on them, surf on them, breathing in and breathing out. Well, the first in a list of five capacities that we develop in Buddhist practice is our capacity for confidence. So as you're sitting here, reflect a little bit about the level of confidence you tend to have. It might vary with what you're doing, but you carry with you a sense of confidence in yourself, confidence in your ability to engage in things, or is your default mode one of lacking confidence? Is your, you know, on a scale you know, 1 to 10, do you tend to have a lot of confidence or you tend to have very little confidence? In times of your life when you felt the most confidence, what does it feel like to be confident? What does it feel like in your body? What's the felt sense of confidence? Can you feel or imagine that confidence is a strength? It's almost like a physical strength. It's almost like a strength of... Now imagine what it would be like if you sat down to meditate. And you sat down and you had a lot of confidence. Yes, this is something I can do. Perhaps it would be a kind of stability and steadiness, just from having this confidence. Confidence is something that can grow and develop over time. One of the values of having confidence is that it gives us inspiration or energy to make effort, to engage in things. If we have confidence, we're more likely to do something. If we lack confidence, we're more likely to hesitate. So confidence is support for making effort, applying oneself, engaging. And the next faculty in the list of five is that of energy, of effort. The energy of applying yourselves, energy of engaging in some practice. Having energy for meditation practice, for example. And energy means so many different things. It can mean just having the vitality to have a good presence of mind available, kind of energized enough, your system's energized enough, you're not falling asleep. It could also mean a kind of persistence in making effort, a kind of like wholeheartedness in engaging in what one's doing. And being constant, being continuous, keeping it up. So how are you with effort in your endeavors? You tend to have really good effort, or is your effort kind of really strong in the beginning and then it fades away quickly, or starts slow and then after a while it kicks in, or do you tend to do things wholehearted with wholehearted effort, or do you tend to do things half-heartedly? Imagine you'd sit down to meditate and there was really good, strong, healthy sense of vitality. energy, good energy in your body. Not restless energy, but stable, strong. You had confidence. You really were... You were going to be persistent. You were going to put yourself wholeheartedly in the activity of meditating. You have the energy for it. You're going to maintain a constant effort. Come back again. Come back again. The next capacity that's cultivated and developed is that of mindfulness. The capacity to really know what's happening in the present moment as it's happening. To be here, not to be lost in thought or lost in the past and the future, but to, in a sense, to be awake or alert, and to notice what's happening in the present. Within you, outside of you. Perhaps you can think of two different events in your life, two situations, where your alertness varied quite a bit. One situation where, in a really nice, good way, you really were alert and present, and could really track and see what was going on and notice what's going on in the present moment. Another situation where maybe you hardly noticed anything at all. You kind of, after a while, say, "What was that? Where was I?" Capacity to pay attention can be developed. Imagine what it would be like to sit down with confidence, good energy, good commitment to keep going with the practice, and to have a strong ability to be in the present, to be alert, awake, here. And the fourth capacity which is developed, cultivated, is that of concentration or stability of mind, steadiness of mind. Sometimes in situations the mind is quite scattered, fragmented. The mind jumps around a lot. In some situations, the mind can be quite steady and strong and doesn't jump anywhere, just stays with whatever the focus is. Reading a really good book, you get absorbed. The mind is really concentrated right there, it doesn't leave. Trying to read the IRS tax code. Most people are not going to have the same level of concentration is a good novel. The mind's going to wander away and be scattered. The capacity to be concentrated can be developed and strengthened like a muscle. So imagine you sit down, what it would be like to sit here confident, with confidence in your body, your mind, really confident in what you're doing. You have energy for it, you're alert and present. And the mind is really steady. There's a steadiness of being inside of you. A rootedness, perhaps, a groundedness. So the awareness can be focused. And then the last capacity that gets developed is the capacity to be discerning. capacity to see, not only see what's happening in the present, but to be wise about what's happening. To be able to evaluate it in a useful way, to know what is helpful, to know what is not helpful. To see clearly what's happening and know what needs to happen. To be discerning, to have street smarts, for example. Meditation discernment can mean knowing what needs to be done in meditation in order to keep your mind focused, concentrated, and mindful. It means knowing what to pay attention to in the present moment so that the meditation can be useful. To know that when the concentration is weak, it's discernment which discerns that, oh, I think I need to develop my concentration. Let's do some concentration practice right now. Or if faith or confidence is really low, discernment is what says, oh, I think I need to cultivate greater confidence in myself. So discernment knows what needs to happen. Using our intelligence to help the spiritual path. So I'll list very slowly these five faculties that we have. And as I say each word, let it sink into you and somehow resonate with something inside of you that you already know in relationship to these. As if they're already part of who you are in some way. Confidence. Effort, mindfulness, concentration. And discernment.